Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. On today's show, our bodies, our gender, male, female, our understanding of these concepts is changing. How is healthcare responding?
So first we're just going to go from head to toe. Okay.
At 20 weeks, a baby in utero is about the size of a banana. And around this time, women typically go in for an extensive ultrasound checkup.
Or this circle here outlines the baby's belly.
The tech measures all of the limbs, checks to make sure all of the organs are where they are supposed to be.
You go through all the measurements of, you know, head size and all these things, and pointing out that all the parts are there and in the right place.
And then the tech will look at some parts more closely, and mom can find out if she's having a boy or a girl.
Then it becomes a sort of celebratory moment of, hooray, you're having a...
Is that a boy?
Is that a boy?
Now we know who this person is that you're carrying, right? They're not just a collection of parts anymore. They suddenly become a person in that moment of revealing the gender.
This is Bryn Mawr College sociologist Piper Sledge, and she says from this moment on, a cascade of things begins to happen. Parents will pick a name for their kid. They start decorating a room.
So we might start painting nurseries certain colors. Grandparents start buying certain kinds of gifts to, you know, for baby showers and that sort of thing. So it's all built in, right? It all starts to roll out from that little piece of information.
But how little or how important is that piece of information, our biology?
Sex is the body, and gender is the sort of cultural meanings we attach to the body.
This distinction has its roots in feminism, that our cultural ideas about men and women shape who we are and how we behave. Other people say biology is creating differences in our brains right from the start.
At approximately 7 weeks in utero, if a embryo is male, it will begin to grow testes and that will secrete testosterone. So that is what leads to the masculinization of the male brain.
That's Toronto neuroscientist Deborah So, and she says increasingly refined imaging techniques reveal differences.
If we look at, say, white matter, we see that the connective tissue in the brain between men and women is different. So men have a greater number of connections running from the front to back of the brain, while women have more connections running interhemispherically. So this is connecting the left and right hemispheres of the brain.
And she says those distinctions in the brain could explain different interests and behaviors between men and women. But sociologist Piper Sledge says even our interpretation of these differences is shaped by cultural ideas around gender.
When it comes to gender, we tend to look at like sex differences, right? Sex differences in the brain. Men's brains are like this, women's brains are like that. And we think that means something. But the idea is that what we're extrapolating from that, what the meanings that we're pulling from that data and the questions we're asking are actually informed by these ideas of what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman.
So there are tensions between those who say gender, as created by society, is what shapes how we act, think, and behave in male or female ways, and those who say biology is far more important. And some argue that gender is not binary, but rather a spectrum. At this complicated and often pretty tense intersection, scientists are exploring differences and what they mean. So on today's show, we'll take a look at what they're finding out and we'll examine how healthcare providers are incorporating these changing ideas into their everyday practice. A lot of the boundaries that once firmly divided men and women no longer exist. Education, jobs, even bathrooms are more mixed now. But there's one realm where health experts are pushing for more and not less separation between men and women, and that's addiction treatment. They say the co-ed approach doesn't work as well here. Liz Tung reports.
Sunday night, a church basement, small town Pennsylvania. In most ways, tonight's gathering is just like any other 12-step meeting. There's coffee, people smoking in the parking lot, and a set script.
All right, can we please open the meeting with the serenity prayer?
that almost everyone in the room knows by heart.
The courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
But there's one thing that makes this group different. It's all women.
My first time here was last week, and I immediately was like, I'm making this my home group.
That's Tanya Berry. She's been in recovery ever since she first got clean from Percocets in 2013. Since then, she started working, gotten engaged, and recently...
Mm-hmm. Give me one second. Yeah. Pick him up.
Had her first baby.
This little muffin is Patrick. He is 5 months old. He's the love of my life. Yes, he is.
But in Alcoholics Anonymous, they say sobriety is never owned, only rented. Tanya had her latest relapse a few weeks ago. That's what convinced her to try out this group, which is one of just a handful of all women's 12-step groups in the entire Philadelphia region.
I know in my situation, there are certain things that I won't bring up in front of a male-dominated room because they don't know what else a woman goes through.
What women go through has become a growing focus in addiction treatment. It's true that more men overall abuse drugs and alcohol, but in recent years, women's heroin use has doubled, and their overdose deaths from prescription painkillers has increased by 400%. For women, the impact of addiction isn't the same.
We want to be and we feel like we're equal with men, but there are some ways we just aren't, you know, and we can't hush that up anymore.
Terry Franklin is a neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Addiction Studies.
How you doing? I'm good.
She says it's only recently that science has started understanding some of the biological differences between men and women that play out in addiction.
The issue with women is that women escalate more rapidly to more use and have more problems related to use. And lately, some of the newer literature is showing that they have more problems with withdrawal.
In her research, Terry's found that a lot of those differences have to do with hormones. For instance, the fact that women's addiction comes on faster and harder. Terry says, in part, it has to do with estradiol, which is a kind of estrogen that spikes during ovulation. During that time of the month, drugs can cause the brain's pleasure center to light up even more than usual. That means higher highs and stronger cravings. Biological findings like this haven't yet trickled down to mainstream addiction treatment. For the most part, treatment caters to men and has for a while.
The Help for Addiction was a, for the most part, a self-help movement that was largely populated by men.
That's Adam Brooks. He leads addiction research at the Public Health Management Corporation. Adam says that in the very early days of modern addiction treatment, there literally was no space for women. When Alcoholics Anonymous started in the 1930s, women were only welcomed as the wives of addicts. In the decades after, women were included more, but Adam says the focus on men's experiences continued to dominate.
Women felt like fish out of water when they would go there, like that their needs weren't being talked about, or that treatment and problems of addiction were rendered in kind of a sexist way.
But now there's another option, gender-specific programs. And so far, studies have found they work. One place that's taken advantage is the Kirkbride Center, a drug and alcohol rehab in West Philadelphia. The director of long-term care, Leslie Horowitz, gave me a tour on a rainy afternoon.
Let's go this way. So there's a detox short-term rehab in that really beautiful part of the building. So all of that is actually women. And then there's two men's floors over here. So there is quite a distance.
Leslie says the whole separate wing thing is nothing new. A lot of inpatient programs keep men and women apart for a practical reason.
I label myself as a sex police around here.
To avoid rehab romance, which is notorious for derailing recovery. But at Kirkbride, they've taken advantage of those separate spaces to introduce a program tailored to women's needs.
Really giving a space for women in recovery, and specifically women and trauma.
So far, a lot of the biological stuff we've learned about female addiction hasn't yet made its way into mainstream treatment. But there has been a growing focus on gender, aka all of the social and cultural stuff that comes along with being a woman. One major factor related to gender is trauma. An estimated 80% of women in addiction treatment have experienced sexual or physical assault. And that's a huge risk factor for addiction.
Why do people use drugs? Because there's a function with it. It reduces trauma symptoms. It numbs you from everything that has happened.
Leslie says the program aims to work through that trauma and develop healthy coping skills. Together, small groups of women talk about their experiences, what gender means, and how all of that's played into their personal histories. That covers everything from violence to relationships to motherhood. Which brings us back to Tanya Berry, the young mom who just started at an all-women's recovery group. She says her most recent relapse was triggered by the kind of gender-specific pressures a lot of women face.
I'm not a single parent, but I feel like a single parent, and I got extremely overwhelmed with life in general. Like, I go to work full-time, but I don't get to come home and go to sleep. I have to take care of the baby. I have to clean the house. I have to cook dinner. I have to do everything.
It's stuff like this, she says, she didn't always feel comfortable bringing up at mixed-gender meetings. But here, she knows a lot of the other women understand what she's going through, because they're going through the same thing. And she's hoping that this time around, that will make the difference.
Nothing to fear. Keep coming back. It works if you work it.
That was Liz Tung reporting. We're talking about how we understand gender, how we understand biology, and how healthcare is responding to changing ideas. Think about a meeting space like the one in Liz's story. It was created to make women feel comfortable to talk among themselves. When there's a lot of guys in the room, let's say at a work meeting, and they're taking over the conversation, maybe they're even getting a little testy with each other, women sometimes joke that there is too much testosterone in the room. Scientists have long known that testosterone, the hormone that makes men develop bigger muscles, facial hair, and deep voices, affects the way men behave. But now they're digging deeper into how this hormone changes the way men think. Reporter Alan Yu went to find out more about this emerging field, and he starts off at a doctor's office where men come to get a boost of sorts.
Dr. Lionel Bisson's practice on the Upper West Side of Manhattan looks like a high-end spa.
Thanks for coming in today.
White walls, black leather sofa, a large red abstract art painting. The doctor is in green scrubs, seeing patients, asking a series of checkup questions.
How much testosterone are you taking?
30.
0.3 cc's.
Yeah.
I get to meet one of his patients. Let's call him Tyler, because he asked us not to use his real name. He says this is a sensitive medical issue for him. He is the president of a tech startup in New York. He started testosterone therapy 7 years ago, during a really stressful time in his life.
I'd wake up in the morning at 5:30. Sometimes I'd fly out to San Francisco and back in the same 24-hour period, raising money, hiring people, building software, and it got to the point where 16, 18-hour days, 7 days a week were regular occurrences. When I first came to see the doctor, he took one look at me and said, "You look like you're about ready to die."
He's in his 40s now, and he says he feels great.
I look and feel 10 years younger than I did when I started treatment. I'm maybe the healthiest I've ever been in my life right now. And I feel like I can be like this for 15 or 20 more years.
He looks fit. He says he wakes up bouncy and light and does competitive Brazilian jiu-jitsu in his spare time. He knows his high workload is not what the body is meant for.
But that's what the world we live in forces you to do in order to advance. And sometimes it just needs science and technology to overcome those hurdles. Some people just physiologically don't have the gas in the tank to go after it. And so that's what this treatment gives you. It doesn't turn you into a comic book hero. It just makes you you again so that you can go out and do the things you were capable of doing.
Tyler's doctor, Lionel Bisson, specializes in anti-aging treatments. During the recession, he started seeing more men for testosterone therapy. Their jobs were at risk.
They wanted to compete in their workplace, but they didn't want to be replaced by a 22-year-old guy who had a normal testosterone level and who was doing more and who was staying up later and going home later and coming in earlier.
Now, it certainly sounds like these men are using testosterone to compete in the workplace, keep themselves going like the Energizer Bunny. But Lionel insists this is a medical treatment. He says Tyler and many of his other patients are hypogonadal. That means their bodies just aren't producing enough testosterone. He says he first does a battery of tests to check their testosterone levels and to rule out other things, like thyroid problems. Lionel does have quite a few patients who work in competitive fields, like finance. And recently, researchers have started studying how testosterone affects the way men think. specifically how men make financial decisions. Neuroscientist John Coates studies how our bodies and hormones can affect the decisions we make. But he had a whole other career before this one. He used to be a trader at Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank. And he noticed something that happened to him and his colleagues whenever they were on winning streaks.
There was an almost narcotic transformation that took place where you began to feel omniscient and omnipotent.
He says narcotic, and that's not a coincidence. He began to suspect during his trading days and later confirmed in his research that testosterone has a big impact on male traders.
You began to think that any thought you thought was going to be true, anything you did was going to work out. You needed less sleep, you carried yourself differently, sort of puffed up and more erect. You didn't really listen to other people's opinions. Statistics really had no ability to calm your enthusiasm. And I had felt this on a number of winning streaks over the course of my career.
I spoke to another researcher in this emerging field, Amos Nadler. He's an assistant professor of finance at Western University in Canada. He got a group of male traders, 140 of them, and randomly dosed some with a little testosterone gel, still within the normal range. He had them trade in a simulated stock market with a board telling them exactly how much the stock they were trading was actually worth.
The groups of guys that got the testosterone gel immediately started to bid much, much higher than the actual value of the asset was. Meaning to say that, say the asset was worth 100, these guys are willing to pay $150, $200, $300 for this asset that's worth a lot less.
The price went up so much it created a bubble, and eventually no one wanted to buy the stock at the absurdly high price, and the pretend market crashed. This happens in real life. Think about the dot-com bubble of the late 90s, the US housing bubble that led to the 2007 recession. Amos cautions that testosterone doesn't cause these changes, it just makes them more likely.
It kind of loads the gun, so to speak, but it doesn't mean that the brain or a person will indiscriminately fire it. It's not like an Incredible Hulk situation.
All of this research is pretty new, so I checked in with Carol Hooven, a behavioral endocrinologist at Harvard, and she studies more generally how hormones affect behavior, and she says testosterone is the hormone that leads men to reproduce, whatever that takes. She says the classic example is red deer. The males live peacefully together, but once breeding season comes around, their testosterone levels spike, they grow antlers to use as weapons, and they fight over the females. Carol says it's reasonable to think that testosterone also leads human men to behave differently. Now, for our ancestors, that may have looked like this.
The male who is able to follow that mammoth for longer or wasn't afraid to go out into the unknown environment and to venture farther away from home.
But now that we don't have to hunt mammoths, maybe one version of risk-taking becomes financial risk. Carol says we need to do a lot more work to understand what exactly is happening.
In one sense, we know a lot about the brain, but in another sense, we know so little. So we do see that testosterone has effects on behavior. We have some ideas about how that might happen, but I would say that research is in its infancy.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. Coming up, when a woman wants to make a major life decision and doctors are cautioning her against it.
You'll meet a man one day who will want you to have his kids, and if you can't do that for him, he won't love you anymore.
That's next on The Pulse.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
We're talking about how healthcare is responding to our changing conversations about gender, about biology. A lot of researchers are looking into bias in medical settings. One aspect of that is how women and men are often treated differently when they go to the doctor or the hospital. For example, studies have found that women having a heart attack are far more likely than men to be dismissed by a doctor. And there are other examples.
When women come in with abdominal pain, unless it's exactly right upper quadrant pain, and appendicitis is not the first thing that you think about.
Valerie Montgomery Rice is an OBGYN and the dean of Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta.
Not that they wouldn't be taken seriously, but the pain would be thought of as more of something that has to do with her female, and I put that in quotation, female problems. If a man comes in with abdominal pain, you automatically ask them questions. I've seen this happen before. Is it pain more on the right side versus the left side? And so then you zoom in. And part of it is because men don't have as many other organs in their abdominal area as women do. And so, of course, that's part of it.
Do you think women are, you said the word, taken seriously. And I have read anecdotally and in some research that women felt their pain was not being taken seriously, or they were told, well, it's not so bad.
Well, you know, I think that there's a gender factor, but there's also, we see that in a race factor. We see that with age factor. In an emergency room, when persons come in and they're in acute pain, I think they are all viewed somewhat, depending on how busy the ER is, to tell you the truth, there's a judgment passed immediately. And so I don't know necessarily, I would not necessarily agree that it's gender so much bias. I think that I've seen much more differences in race and socioeconomic status.
Valerie says people bring who they are to work, and doctors are no exception. They have unconscious biases that can affect how they interact with a patient. Journalist Bree Ripley says she encountered gender bias when she wanted to get her tubes tied. She's 24 and had decided in her teens that she never wanted to have children. But when she went looking to get the procedure done, she was told no again and again. She says the pushback she got didn't seem like clinical opinions. Instead, she felt the doctor's refusal was based on their ideas about what's best for a young woman. Here's her story.
My mom was the first person to tell me, you don't have to have babies. And that made sense to me.
You know how people imagine getting married and having weddings? I didn't really dream of any of that. In fact, I didn't think I was going to have kids.
What changed your mind?
Getting pregnant with you.
That's my mom. For my entire childhood, she was addicted to pain meds. Then later, she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, the kind where she was in and out of the hospital for suicide attempts. Watching my mom struggle made me feel helpless, and like I was dealing with the side effects of her illness. Coaches often had to drive me home after basketball practice because my mom would either forget or be too high to drive. And when my mom forgot to pack my lunch, kind cafeteria workers at school let me have free lunch so I could eat those little square pizza slices. If I was to have children, I know that it's only slightly likely that I would pass along my mom's issues to them. I decided that I didn't want to take any chance on that. And I get that plenty of people with mental health issues live happy, healthy, full lives. But this decision isn't about other people. This is about me and what I want for myself and for my future, which is why I wanted to nip my branch of the family tree in the bud. So when I was 17, I started asking doctors to sterilize me, but they wouldn't. They told me things like, "You're too young to know this is the right choice for you." I put a call out to speak with women who wanted to get their tubes tied. A lot of them heard similar things from their doctors.
Basically, I was just told, absolutely not, no way, no how. You have to have kids first.
Well, what if you change your mind, and what if you meet a nice guy?
You'll meet a man one day who will want you to have his kids, and if you can't do that for him, he won't love you anymore.
She needed to have both of us do marriage counseling for a year.
When I was 20, she told me to ask again at 23.
It was a decade of trying to get them tied.
Then at 23, she told me to ask again at 25.
Not until you've turned 35.
Oh, you'll change your mind.
Oh, you'll change your mind.
I changed my mind.
Tequila Rivera is one of the women I spoke with. She's wanted to have her tubes tied since she was 16. Instead, doctors offered her less permanent forms of birth control, like the NuvaRing. But after a year of using it, she wasn't feeling right. She wondered, dang, could I be pregnant?
I went to the doctor and they did a pregnancy test and they were like, no, you're not pregnant. You're using the NuvaRing correctly. We don't know what's wrong. So I go back to the doctor a couple of weeks later and they were like, oh, you actually are pregnant. We're sorry. And I'm thinking, oh.
That oh moment, that's a moment of realization I'm trying to avoid. So I've tried the pill, the patch, the arm implant, and the Depo-Provera shot. Every one of these birth control options came with a litany of hormonal side effects, which felt like my emotions were out of control. So finally, I tried an IUD, but after a year of using that, my body expelled it during a particularly painful period. Less permanent options didn't work for me. I know you guys might be thinking, this pushback from doctors who refused to tie my tubes is all about me being young. But it's not. It's about doctors not trusting me as a woman with my own body. I spoke with women who were in their 40s and in their 50s who also got a lot of pushback when they inquired about making the same decision. Angela Hinorio is one of them. When she decided to have a child in 1989, when she was 41, she wanted to have her tubes tied right after she gave birth, but doctors refused to do it.
So they told me that if I still wanted to tie my tubes in 2 or 3 years, they would do it.
When my guy friend, Luke Beetham, decided he never wanted to be a dad, it was a lot easier. He was 29, single, and didn't have any children when he reached out to a physician named Dr. Snip. The doctor only performs vasectomies.
I did a pre-visit, an interview to find out if I was a candidate, and I think given like a cool-off period of maybe a week or a couple weeks.
A couple of weeks. That's annoying to hear. I'd been trying to find a doctor who would tie my tubes for 5 years, but there's just not anything like a walk-in vasectomy clinic for women. There are online resources. Thanks to some journalistic sleuthing, I found a message board called a subreddit. And that's when I found an OBGYN named Sue Marini. Presto. Thanks, Internet. After a short doctor's visit where I assured her this was something I really wanted for myself, we scheduled my surgery.
And then here's the NAMI medication, make you a little sting.
And let's see, any allergies? Are you allergic to any medication?
No.
Have you ever had a reaction to latex?
No.
No, okay, perfect.
The tubal ligation option I chose was one that removed my fallopian tubes entirely. It's been just over a year since the procedure. I'm 24 now. And I feel closer to my ideal self. And intimacy is great now that I don't think about an unplanned pregnancy. But I look forward to all the other surprises that life's gonna bring me.
That's journalist Bree Ripley telling us her story. She's in her 20s, and she had wanted to get her tubes tied ever since she was a teenager. I asked Valerie Montgomery Rice if this ever came up in her practice, that a young woman came in who wanted to get her tubes tied. She's the dean of Morehouse School of Medicine.
When I was fully practicing obstetrics and gynecology, I would see young women who would come in who had decided that they did not want to have children. The younger they were, I would definitely say the more concerned I was about it. First of all, from a clinical point of view, if you think about a man having a vasectomy, it is easier to do a reversal of a vasectomy than it is to do a reversal of a tubal ligation. I have done multiple tubal ligation reversals in my lifetime. It's microscopic surgery that can be very, very tedious, and it typically you have a lot of scar tissue.
And she admits this is a very difficult topic. She has seen older, often male colleagues not give full credence to women's decisions.
But I will say, I am biased somewhat with them because I have seen too many women change their mind after the age of 35 and 40. And then we are playing significant catch-up with their decision.
Do you think healthcare providers are getting better at providing care that is, you know, gender-informed but without being biased?
I know we're getting better with educating and training the next generation of healthcare professionals. We spend a lot of time not just throwing information out at students and saying this is what you're supposed to do, but putting them in real case scenarios where they have to test their biases and test their value systems and listen and learn from others And then we help them to self-examine many times where their biases come from. We also do a lot of simulation and standardized patients. So I know we're getting better.
That's Morehouse Medical School Dean Valerie Montgomery Rice. And the standardized patients she just mentioned, they're actors pretending to be sick. They come in for a practice checkup. Some med schools are now introducing their students to transgender standardized patients. Studies show that transgender people often face discrimination at doctors' offices. Some reported being verbally harassed. Others had doctors refuse to take care of them. New York University School of Medicine is trying to better prepare students to care for this population. Alex Stern sat in on a practice session.
Bianca Lee is sitting in a fake exam room with a one-way mirror. She drapes her cardigan over the back of her chair and smiles confidently. Today, she's playing a character named Tia Lopez.
Tia Lopez is a 36-year-old woman of trans experience. She works as a bartender, and she has come for her annual physical.
Bianca is a transgender woman in her 50s. She waits until a booming voice comes over the PA system with instructions for the next student.
You may now enter the room.
Come in.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm Sandra Goldust. I see your name is Tia on my chart. Mm-hmm. What name do you prefer to go by? Do you go by Tia or do you go by a different
Tia.
Name? You go by Tia. So yeah.
Sandra is a student in NYU's 3-year med school program. This is her first time interacting with a patient, standardized or otherwise, and Bianca, or Tia, is ready to throw her some curveballs.
Mm-hmm. And what pronouns do you usually use to refer to yourself?
You ask everybody that?
I ask almost a lot of my patients that, yes, okay. But I do see you're a trans woman, so I just wanted to clarify just so that I know and I can respect that.
Isn't it obvious? I'm 100% female. Yes, she, her.
Just wanted to always...
I know, it's a whole new world.
That's the point of having a standardized patient. To practice situations that might be a little uncomfortable or off script. Sandra and the other med students have been taught the basics of trans-specific care in the classroom. Best practices like how to talk about hormones and asking for preferred pronouns at the beginning of a visit. But the classroom can only get you so far. For example, Bianca says that some people, especially older trans people, don't take kindly to being asked which pronouns they use.
I mean, they're transgender people that are like, I am a woman, and that's it. And I don't want to talk about it.
After the exam, Bianca gives Sandra some feedback.
Hi, Sandra. How do you feel?
Okay, I feel like there's a lot of things I need to learn, for sure.
Uh-huh. My main concern mm-hmm. is less about forgetting one or two things on this, mm-hmm. and how you come in the room, mm-hmm. and how you interact with a patient.
Okay.
And I thought you did fabulous.
Thank you.
You know, even if you feel nervous, you present calm, competent.
This part
mature.
Of the training program is fairly new at NYU. Richard Green is a professor there, and he made it a part of the curriculum after studying how his students examined a trans-standardized patient. Most of them were perfectly polite, but some of them skirted around her gender identity. Less than 2/3 of students even brought it up.
And so it's certainly possible that she was sitting there in that room feeling like, what if they figure it out? Or what if they say something different? Or what if something happens? And by addressing her gender identity directly in a non-judgmental and inclusive way or affirming way, you allow her to be who she is and to really talk about what her concerns are.
Once they've established the basics, doctors can focus on why their patients came in that day, which might not have anything to do with gender identity at all.
Transgender people fall and break their arm, or they have diabetes, or they need to stop smoking, or any of those things that we would treat any other patient for.
Research has shown that when people feel uncomfortable or mistreated at the doctor's office, they're less likely to go and less likely to get the care that they need. So training is crucial.
Having this opportunity to talk to a trans patient means that the next time they walk into a room with a trans patient, they're going to feel much more comfortable.
It's Richard's hope that if future doctors are more comfortable, future patients will be as well.
That was Alex Stern reporting. This is The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. Doing better, being more inclusive, usually involves changing up the way you hire employees and the way you train staff. But it's not just people who come to a job with biases. Our tech has them, too.
So I'm Sarah Wachter-Betcher. I'm a user experience consultant and the author of the new book, Technically Wrong.
Sarah writes about how sexist assumptions make their way into computer programs and apps. For example, the Apple Health app that was launched a couple of years ago.
So you could track things like all of your workouts. You could track things like resting heart rate, and you could track nutrition, your chromium intake, all of these very minute details about health, right? But for a full year after it launched, what you could not track with Apple Health was menstruation. It didn't have a period tracker.
And then what happened? They fixed that.
Well, first, people complained and, you know, you had to read 10,000 think pieces about it. And then eventually they were like, oh, wow, yeah.
Or there was a British doctor who couldn't swipe into her gym's women's locker room.
Her title in the system was doctor. And their database had been coded so that anybody with the title of doctor was listed as a male, could only access the men's locker room.
This kind of thing happens all the time. Why is that? Sarah says it's not ill intent.
I'm sure nobody sat down and said, I know what would be really cool is if this product excludes women.
But most of the people who create these apps are men who may not be challenging their own assumptions. And bias is buried deeper than that. It's already baked in the cake in ways we might not realize.
A few years ago, Google researchers put together this system called Word2Vec. And what it does, it's essentially designed to help you with natural language processing.
Basically, it looks at connections between pieces of data to help understand what language actually means. It's a really fundamental part of artificial intelligence.
In Word2Vec, what they did is they took a whole bunch of texts and they took them from Google News results. And so they used all of these Google News articles and fed them to their system. And they said, okay, use all of these texts and learn what these words mean and how these words mean things together. And based off of that, the system was able to learn things like Paris is to France as Tokyo is to blank, right? So it could answer questions like that because it started to understand that, oh, those are relationships and, you know, like man is to woman as king is to queen. Okay, great. But one of the other things that that system started to do is it started to draw relationships that were a little bit different. So it started to say things like man is to woman as computer programmer is to homemaker.
So those outdated connections in news articles like woman and homemaker, the Google system took them to be truth.
So what these algorithms are doing is they're essentially taking information from our past and they end up projecting it into our future. So they do that because something like Word2Vec is being used as an underlying technology that other people are building things on top of.
For example, it could become the foundation for programs that scan through resumes and lead to hiring decisions, or software being used by a hospital system to come up with patient questionnaires. Sarah says for tech to be more inclusive, the industry has to not only get more diverse in terms of staffing, but also pay attention to underlying biases in systems that were already created. Sarah Wachter-Betcher's new book is Technically Wrong. Coming up, learning vocal tricks to make your voice match your gender identity.
Right on.
Meow, 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 meow.
Very nice. All right.
That's next on The Pulse.
University of Pennsylvania's Medical Ethics and Health Policy Department supports The Pulse. Their online Master of Healthcare Innovation addresses the rapidly changing healthcare landscape by advancing innovation among healthcare professionals through online education. Penn faculty who work in health policy, behavioral economics, and operations management prepare students to influence policy, improve processes, and lead innovation. Applications for Penn's next cohort are due February 15th. More at improvinghealthcare.net.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Healthcare providers are changing their services to match the needs of people who are trying to figure out what gender means in their lives. Vocal therapists usually work with clients who've had injuries like nodules, even types of cancer. But now some vocal therapists are expanding their services to help transgender clients who want to make their voices more feminine or masculine to match their identities. Paige Flager reports.
As an actress, Alice Gorlick knows how important presentation is. She has to look the part, dress the part, and sound the part. But as a transgender woman, that last qualification is a little bit more complicated than it is for other actresses.
I'm playing parts that I've never played before. Like, I just had to play a femme fatale, basically, which was really difficult for me. And, you know, my voice has to be sultry.
Alice is 23 and has thick-rimmed glasses and brown hair. She came to New York City to break into the theater scene. She's always disliked her voice, but that feeling grew more intense after she came out as trans.
I think there was a time that I was at a sandwich restaurant and the guy called me Miss as I walked up to the counter, but then when he was making my sandwich and I had to like tell him what I wanted, he started calling me Sir.
Can you give me a sense of like what that feels like in that moment?
It's kind of like the world doesn't see the way you want to be seen, and just like you can't even talk, like you feel speechless.
It was interactions like that one that led Alice to see vocal therapist Christy Block from New York Speech and Voice Lab in Manhattan. Christy's office is on the 8th floor of a high-rise. It's a cozy space with a large office plant and a wall of books. These days, about half of her clients are transgender people, mostly transgender women, like Alice. That's because people who transition to male can take testosterone, which lowers their voices, but people who transition to female typically have thicker vocal folds and deeper voices, and hormones don't change that. When Christy works with her clients, she's focusing on three things.
Primarily, it's about pitch. Pitch is like the note you play on an instrument. And so which note you pick might be in the feminine range versus masculine range.
With Alice, she aims for the note A3, right in the middle of the feminine range.
Now, can I hear an A3?
Yes.
And then there's intonation.
Intonation is how many notes you play, how high and low. We don't speak like robots like this. It's not monotone like this.
Feminine intonation is generally higher, longer, and moves around more.
So an example would be, "Hi, how are you? Hi, how are you?"
Alice practices this by buzzing up and down.
Good. Very good.
A more masculine intonation is shorter and moves downward.
Hi, how are you? Hey, how's it going?
And then there's the concept of resonance. A masculine resonance comes from the back of the mouth, using the full space inside to make the sound deep and round.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Versus
a more feminine voice, which is further forward, using less space in the mouth to produce a brighter, more nasal sound.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It's playing the same note on a violin versus a cello, where the violin has a smaller body and the cello has a bigger body. And the violin sounds much more tinny and bright and smaller. And the cello sounds much bigger and darker sounding.
Me, 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 me.
Good. So tell me what you're trying to do. That's right.
Yeah, I'm making my voice as nasally as possible. So I'm only using my resonance in my nose, and then I adjust it until it sounds normal. Me, me,
me, me. Christy and Alice have been working together for about 6 months, but their lessons aren't covered by insurance. Christy says the majority of her clients can't get coverage for her services. Alice pays out of pocket, but when she hears her progress, she feels like it's been worth it.
Whenever you're ready.
When the sunlight strikes raindrops in the air, they act as a prism and form a rainbow. The rainbow is a division of white light into many beautiful colors. These take the shape of a long round arch with its path high above and its two ends apparently beyond the horizon.
All right, so let's listen to you reading the same rainbow passage back in January 2017, before training.
When the sunlight strikes raindrops in the air, they act as a prism and form a rainbow.
The rainbow is a division of white light into many beautiful colors.
These take the shape of a long round arch with its path high above
and its two ends apparently beyond the horizon.
Wow. Very nice.
Thanks.
Absolutely. Your original pitch was 110 hertz, which is lower than average for cisgender male. Mm-hmm. So you've come way up into feminine range. So bravo.
Thank you.
Yay.
That was Paige Flager reporting. We've visited a bunch of different places today where healthcare providers are responding to new ideas about gender, about biology. But among the people who are trying to tease apart the definitions and concepts, there's still a lot of unknowns and tensions. For example, Toronto neuroscientist Deborah So says researchers who point out differences in men's and women's brains are getting pushback.
I think there's been a growing movement towards really emphasizing equality between the sexes, and I think that's a positive thing. And obviously, as a woman, I think that's an amazing thing. But I think with that has come this misguided idea that we have to pretend men and women are the same.
What good could come if we better understood whatever biological differences we have in our brains and how they shape us? If we better understood that, what good could come from that?
With these differences that we see between men and women, you know, there are implications for health. Say, when we look outside of the brain, if we look at health risks for, say, heart attack and stroke, there are differences between men and women. So the same with regards to, you know, psychological conditions, being able to offer better support, maybe tailoring that support in a way that would be more effective.
Sociologist Piper Sledge says, sure, there are differences between men and women.
I do believe that there are. Because I believe we've constructed them as a society, right? These are things that are real and they impact us.
So what's her take on scientists studying sex hormones, brain connections, biological differences? So do you see your field sort of battling with that field, or are you really complementing each other in some way? Or you could talk to each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think that should happen, right? I think the neuroscientists studying the brain need to talk with sociologists. This is not, we can't actually have truly objective science, particularly when we're talking about sex differences, right? We're so hyper-focused on the differences that we overlook the massive similarities. And so I think that's a place where the two should be in conversation. And I think if that were to happen, we would have better science.
So we'll stay tuned as this exploration and hopefully conversation continues. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Lana Gordon, Irina Zhurov, Alan Yu, and Liz Tung. Our interns are Elizabeth Estrada and Abby Holtzman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager and Alex Stern our associate producers. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center supports the Pulse. With community cardiology practices throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Penn's Heart and Vascular Center has made a commitment to deliver advanced treatment options, personalized care, and convenient access close to home. Learn more about Penn's Heart and Vascular Center at pennheart.org or 800-789-PENN. Your life is worth Penn Medicine.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.